put it beside her, but she thrashed and knocked it onto the floor with a hollow banging sound which he also couldn't hear. He picked it up and just held it, watching her.
"Johnny!" she screamed. "I can't find my sewing box. It isn't in the closet."
He poured her a glass of water from the pitcher on the nightstand and held it to her lips, but she thrashed again and almost knocked it from his grasp. He set it back down where it would be in reach if she quieted. He had never been so bitterly aware of his muteness as the last 2 days had made him. The Methodist minister, Braceman, had been with her on the 23rd when Nick came over. He was Bible reading with her in the living room, but he looked nervous and anxious to get away. Nick could guess why. Her fever had given her a rosy, girlish glow that went jarringly with her bereavement. Perhaps the minister had been afraid she was going to make a pass at him. More likely, though, he had been anxious to gather up his family and melt away over the fields. News travels fast in a small town, and others had already decided to get out of Shoyo. Since the time Braceman had left the Baker living room some 48 hours ago, everything had turned into a waking nightmare. Mrs. Baker had gotten worse, so much worse that Nick had feared she would die before the sun went down. Worse, he couldn't sit with her constantly. He had gone down to the truck stop to get his 3 prisoners lunch, but Vince Hogan hadn't been able to eat. He was delirious. Mike Childress and Billy Warner wanted out, but Nick couldn't bring himself to do it. It wasn't fear. He didn't believe they would waste any time working him over to settle their grievance. They would want to make fast tracks away from Shoyo like the others. But he had a responsibility. He had made a promise to a man who was now dead. Surely, sooner or later, the state patrol would get things in hand and come to take them away. He found a .45 rolled up in its holster in the bottom drawer of Baker's desk, and after a few moments of debate, he put it on. Looking down and seeing the wood-grip butt of the gun lying against his skinny hip had made him feel ridiculous, but its weight was comforting. He had opened Vince's cell on the afternoon of the 23rd and had put makeshift ice packs on the man's forehead, chest, and neck. Vince had opened his eyes and looked at Nick with such silent, miserable appeal that Nick wished he could say anything, as he wished it now, 2 days later, with Mrs. Baker. Anything that would give the man a moment's comfort. Just, "You'll be okay," or "I think the fever's breaking," would be enough. All the time he was tending to Vince, Billy and Mike were yelling at him. While he was bent over the sick man, they didn't matter, but he saw their scared faces every time he looked up, their lips forming words that all came down to the same thing. "Please let us out." Nick was careful to keep away from them. He wasn't grown, but he was old enough to know that panic makes men dangerous. That afternoon he had shuttled back and forth on nearly empty streets, always expecting to find Vince Hogan dead on one end or Jane Baker dead on the other. He looked for Dr. Soames's car, but didn't see it. That afternoon a few of the shops had still been open, and the Texaco, but he became more and more convinced that the town was emptying out. People were taking paths through the woods, logging roads, maybe even wading up Shoyo Stream, which passed through Smackover and eventually came out in the town of Mount Holly. More would leave after dark, Nick thought. The sun had just gone down when he arrived at the Baker house to find Jane moving shakily around the kitchen in her bathrobe, brewing tea. She looked at Nick gratefully when he came in, and he saw her fever was gone.
"I want to thank you for watching after me," she said calmly. "I feel ever so much better. Would you like a cup of tea?"
And then she burst into tears. He went to her, afraid she might faint and fall against the hot stove. She held his arm to steady herself and laid her head against him, her hair a dark flood against the light blue robe.
"Johnny," she said in the darkening kitchen. "Oh, my poor Johnny."
If he could speak, Nick thought unhappily, but he could only hold her, and guide her across the kitchen to a chair by the table.
"The tea,"
he pointed to himself and then made her sit down.
"All right," she said. "I do feel better, remarkably so. It's just that, just—"
She put her hands over her face. Nick made them hot tea and brought it to the table. They drank for a while without speaking. She held her cup in both hands like a child. At last she put her cup down and said, "How many in town have this, Nick?"
"I don't know anymore," Nick wrote. "It's pretty bad."
"Have you seen the doctor?"
"Not since this morning."
"Em will wear himself out if he's not careful," she said. "He'll be careful, won't he, Nick, not to wear himself out?"
Nick nodded and tried to smile.
"What about John's prisoners? Has the patrol come for them?"
"No," Nick wrote. "Hogan is very sick. I'm doing what I can. The others want me to let them out before Hogan can make them sick."
"Don't you let them out," she said with some spirit. "I hope you're not thinking of it."
"No," Nick wrote, and after a moment he added, "You ought to go back to bed. You need rest."
She smiled at him, and when she moved her head, Nick could see the dark smudges under the angles of her jaw, and he wondered uneasily if she was out of the woods yet.
"Yes, I'm going to sleep the clock right around. It seems wrong somehow to sleep with John dead. I can hardly believe he is, you know. I keep stumbling over the idea like something I forgot to put away."
He took her hand and squeezed it. She smiled wanly.
"There may be something else to live for in time. Have you gotten your prisoners their supper, Nick?"
Nick shook his head.
"You ought to. Why don't you take John's car?"
"I can't drive," Nick wrote, "but thank you. I'll just walk down to the truck stop. It isn't far. And check on you in the morning, if that's all right."
"Yes," she said, "fine."
He got up and pointed sternly at the teacup.
"Every drop," she promised.
He was going out the screen door when he felt her hesitant touch on his arm.
"John,"
she said, stopped, and then forced herself to go on.
"I hope they took him to the Curtis mortuary. That's where John's folks and mine have always been buried out of. Do you think they took him there all right?"
Nick nodded. The tears brimmed over her cheeks, and she began to sob again. When he left her that night, he had gone directly to the truck stop. A closed sign hung crookedly in the window. He had gone around to the house trailer and back, but it was locked and dark. No one answered his knock. Under the circumstances, he felt he was justified in a little breaking and entering. There would be enough in Sheriff Baker's petty cash box to pay any damages. He hammered in the glass by the restaurant's lock and let himself in. The place was spooky, even with all the lights on. The jukebox dark and dead, no one at the bumper pool table or the video games, the booths empty, the stools unoccupied. The hood was over the grill. Nick went out back and fried some hamburgers on the gas stove and put them in a sack. He added a bottle of milk and half an apple pie that stood under a plastic dome on the counter. Then he went back to the jail, after leaving a note on the counter explaining who had broken in and why. Vince Hogan was dead. He lay on the floor of his cell amid a clutter of melting ice and wet towels. He had clawed at his neck at the end as if he had been resisting an invisible strangler. The tips of his fingers were bloody. Flies were lighting on him and buzzing off. His neck was as black and swollen as an inner tube some heedless child has pumped up to the point of bursting.
"Now will you let us out?" Mike Childress asked. "He's dead, you fucking mutie. Are you satisfied? You feel revenged yet? Now he's got it, too."
He pointed to Billy Warner. Billy looked terrified. There were hectic red splotches on his neck and cheeks. The arm of his work shirt, with which he had repeatedly wiped at his nose, was stiff with snot.
"That's a lie," he chanted hysterically. "A lie! A lie! A fucking lie! That's a lie!"
He began to sneeze suddenly, doubling over with the force of them, expelling a heavy spray of saliva and mucus.
"See?" Mike demanded. "Huh? You happy, you fucking mutie dimwit? Let me out. You can keep him if you want to, but not me. It's murder, that's all it is. Cold-blooded murder."
Nick shook his head, and Mike had a tantrum. He began to throw himself against the bars of his cell, bruising his face, bloodying the knuckles of both hands. He stared at Nick with bulging eyes while he banged his forehead repeatedly. Nick waited until he got tired and then pushed the food through the slots in the bottoms of the cells with the broom handle. Billy Warner looked at him dully for a moment, then began to eat. Mike threw his glass of milk against the bars. It shattered and milk sprayed everywhere. He slammed his two burgers against the graffiti-covered rear wall of his cell. One of them stuck in a splat of mustard, ketchup, and relish that was grotesquely cheery, like a Jackson Pollock painting. He jumped up and down on his slice of apple pie, boogieing on it. Apple chunks flew every which way. The white plastic plate splintered.
"I'm on a hunger strike," he yelled. "Fucking hunger strike. I won't eat nothing. You'll eat my dingle before I eat anything you bring me, you fucking deaf-mute retard asshole. You'll—"
Nick turned away, and silence immediately descended. He went back out into the office, not knowing what to do, scared. If he could drive, he would take them up to Camden himself. But he couldn't drive. And there was Vince to think about. He couldn't just let him lie there, drawing flies. There were two doors opening off the office. One was a coat closet. The other led down a flight of stairs. Nick went down and saw it was a combination cellar and storage room. It was cool down there. It would do, at least for a while. He went back upstairs. Mike was sitting on the floor, morosely picking up squashed apple slices, brushing them off and eating them. He didn't look up at Nick. Nick gathered the body up in his arms and tried to lift it. The sick smell coming off the corpse was making his stomach do cartwheels and handstands. Vince was too heavy for him. He looked at the body helplessly for a moment and became aware that both of the others were now standing at their cell doors, watching with a dreadful fascination. Nick could guess what they were thinking. Vince had been one of them, a whiny gas bag maybe, but someone they hung with just the same. He had died like a rat in a trap with some horrible swelling sickness they didn't understand. Nick wondered, not for the first time that day, when he would start to sneeze and run a fever and develop those peculiar swellings on his neck. He laid hold of Vince Hogan's meaty forearms and dragged him out of the cell. Vince's head leaned toward him because of the weight on his shoulders, and he seemed to be looking at Nick, wordlessly telling him to be careful, not to joggle him too much. It took 10 minutes to get the big man's remains down the steep stairs. Panting, Nick laid him on the concrete under the fluorescence and then covered him quickly with a frayed army blanket from the cot in his cell. He tried to sleep then, but sleep only came in the early hours of the morning after June 23rd had become the 24th, yesterday. His dreams had always been very vivid, and sometimes he was afraid of them. He rarely had out-and-out nightmares, but more and more often lately, they were ominous, giving him the feeling that no one in them was exactly as they seemed, and that the normal world had skewed into a place where babies were sacrificed behind closed blinds, and stupendous black machines roared on in locked basements. And of course there was the very personal terror that he would wake up with it himself. He did sleep a little, and the dream that came was one he had had before recently. The cornfield, the smell of warm growing things, the feel that something or someone very good and safe was close, a sense of home. And that began to fade into cold terror as he became aware that something was in the corn, watching him. He thought, "Ma, weasels got in the hen house," and awoke to early morning light, sweat standing out on his body. He put coffee on and went in to check on his two prisoners. Mike Childress was in tears. Behind him, the hamburger was still stuck on the wall in its drying glue of condiments.
"You satisfied now? I got it, too. Ain't that what you wanted? Ain't that your revenge? Listen to me, I sound like a fucking freight train going up a hill."
But Nick's first concern had been for Billy Warner, who lay comatose on his bunk. His neck was swelled and black, his chest rising in fits and starts. He hurried back to the office, looked at the telephone, and in a fit of rage and guilt he knocked it off the desk and onto the floor, where it lay meaninglessly at the end of its cord. He turned the hot plate off and ran down the street to the Baker house. He pushed the bell for what seemed an hour before Jane came down, wrapped in her robe. The fever sweat was back on her face. She was not delirious, but her words were slow and slurry, and her lips were blistered.
"Nick, come in. What is it?"
"V. Hogan died last night. Warner's dying, I think. He's awful sick. Have you seen Dr. Soames?" She shook her head, shivered in the light draft, sneezed, and then swayed on her feet. Nick put an arm around her shoulders and led her to a chair. He wrote, "Can you call his office for me?"
"Yes, of course. Bring me the phone, Nick. I seem to have had a setback in the night."
He brought the phone over and she dialed Soames's number. After she had held the receiver to her ear for more than half a minute, he knew there was going to be no answer. She tried his home, then the home of his nurse. No answer.
"I'll try the state patrol," she said,
but put the phone back in the cradle after dialing a single number. "The long distance is still out of service, I guess. After I dial one, it just goes wah, wah, wah in my ear." She gave him a pallid smile, and then the tears began to flow helplessly.
"Poor Nick," she said. "Poor me. Poor everybody. Could you help me upstairs? I feel so weak and I can't catch my breath. I think I'll be with John soon."
He looked at her, wishing he could speak.
"I think I'll lie down if you can help me."
He helped her upstairs, then wrote, "I'll be back."
"Thank you, Nick. You're a good boy."
She was already drifting off to sleep. Nick left the house and stood on the sidewalk, wondering what to do next. If he could drive, he might be able to do something, but he saw a child's bicycle lying on the lawn of a house across the street. He went to it, looked at the house it belonged to with its drawn shades, so much like the houses in his confused dreams, then went and knocked on the door. There was no answer, although he knocked several times. He went back to the bike. It was small, but not too small for him to ride, if he didn't mind his knees whamming the handlebars. He would look ludicrous, of course, but he was not at all sure there was anyone left in Shoyo to see, and if there was, he didn't think many of them would be in a laughing frame of mind. He got on the bike and pedaled clumsily up Main Street, past the jail, then east on Route 63, toward where Joe Rackman had seen the soldiers masquerading as a road crew. If they were still there, and if they really were soldiers, Nick would get them to take care of Billy Warner and Mike Childress. If Billy was still alive, that was. If those men had quarantined Shoyo, then surely the sick of Shoyo were their responsibility. It took him an hour to pedal out to the roadwork, the bike weaving crazily back and forth across the center line, his knees thumping the handlebars with monotonous regularity. But when he got there, the soldiers, or road crew, or whatever they had been, were gone. There were a few smudge pots, one of them still flickering. There were two orange sawhorses, and the road had been torn up, although Nick judged it would still be passable if you weren't too choosy about the springs of your car. Black flickering movement caught the tail of his eye, and at the same instant the wind stirred around a little, just a soft summer breath, but enough to bring a ripe and sickening odor of corruption to his nostrils. The black movement was a cloud of flies, constantly forming and reforming itself. He walked the bike over to the ditch at the far side of the road. In it, next to a shiny new corrugated culvert pipe, were the bodies of four men. Their necks and swollen faces were black. Nick didn't know if they were soldiers or not, and he didn't go any closer. He told himself he would walk back to the bike. There was nothing here to be scared about. They were dead, and dead people couldn't hurt you. He was running by the time he was 20 feet from the ditch, anyway, and he was in a panic as he rode back toward Shoyo. On the outskirts of town, he hit a rock and crashed the bike. He went over the handlebars, bumped his head, and scraped his hands. He only hunkered there for a moment in the middle of the road, shivering all over. For the next hour and a half of that morning, yesterday morning, Nick knocked on doors and rang bells. There would be someone well, he told himself. He himself felt all right, and surely he could not be the only one. There would be someone, a man, a woman, maybe a teenager with a learner's permit, and he or she would say, "Oh, hey, yes, let's get them to Camden. We'll take the station wagon," or words to that effect. But his knocking and ringing were answered less than a dozen times. The door would open to the length of a latch chain, a sick but hopeful face would look out, see Nick, and hope would die. The face would move back and forth in negation, and then the door would shut. If Nick could talk, he would have argued if they could still walk, they could drive, that if they took his prisoners to Camden, they could go themselves, and there would be a hospital. they would be made well. But he couldn't speak. Some asked if he had seen Dr. Soames. One man, in a delirious rage, threw the door of his small ranch house wide open, staggered out on the porch dressed only in his underpants, and tried to grab Nick. He said he was going to do what I should have done to you back in Houston. He seemed to think Nick was someone named Jenner. He lurched back and forth along the porch after Nick like a zombie in a third-rate horror picture. His crotch had swelled terribly. His underpants looked as if someone had stuffed a honeydew melon into them. At last he crashed to the porch, and Nick watched him from the lawn below, his heart thumping rapidly. The man shook his fist weakly, then crawled back inside, not bothering to shut the door. But most of the houses were only silent and cryptic, and at last he could do no more. That dream sense of ominousness was creeping up on him, and it became impossible to dismiss the idea that he was knocking on the doors of tombs, knocking to wake the dead, and that sooner or later the corpses might begin to answer. It didn't help much to tell himself that most of the houses were empty, their occupants already fled to Camden or El Dorado or Texarkana. He went back to the Baker house. Jane Baker was sleeping deeply, her forehead cool, but this time he wasn't as hopeful. It was noon. Nick went back to the truck stop, feeling his night's broken rest now. His body seemed to throb all over from his spill off the bike. Baker's 45 banged his hip. At the truck stop, he heated two cans of soup and put them in thermos jugs. The milk in the fridge still seemed fine, so he took a bottle of that, too. Billy Warner was dead, and when Mike saw Nick, he began to giggle hysterically and point his finger.
Two down and one to go. Two down and one to go. You're getting your revenge, right? Right?
Nick carefully pushed the thermos of soup through the slot with the broom handle, and then a big glass of milk. Mike began to drink soup directly from the thermos in small sips. Nick took his own thermos and sat down in the hallway. He would take Billy downstairs, but first he would have lunch. He was hungry. As he drank his soup, he looked at Mike thoughtfully.
"You wondering how I am?" Mike asked.
Nick nodded.
"Just the same as when you left this morning. I must have hawked out a pound of snot."
He looked at Nick hopefully.
"My mom always said that when you hawked snot like that, you was getting better. Maybe I just got a mild case, huh? You think that might be?"
Nick shrugged. Anything was possible.
"I got the constitution of a brass eagle," Mike said. "I think it's nothing. I think I'll throw it off. Listen, man, let me out, please. I'm fucking begging you now."
Nick thought about it.
"Hell, you got the gun. I don't want you for nothing anyway. I just want to get out of this town. I want to check on my wife first."
Nick pointed to Mike's left hand, which was bare of rings.
"Yeah, we're divorced, but she's still here in town, out on the Ridge Road. I'd like to look in on her. What do you say, man?"
Mike was crying.
"Give me a chance. Don't keep me locked up in this rat trap."
Nick stood up slowly, went out into the office, and opened the desk drawer. The keys were there. The man's logic was inexorable. There was no sense in believing that someone was going to come and bail them out of this terrible mess. He got the keys and went back. He held up the one Big John Baker had shown him with the tag of white tape on it and tossed them through the bars to Mike Childress.
"Thanks," Mike babbled. "Oh, thanks. I'm sorry we beat up on you. I swear to God, it was Ray's idea. Me and Vince tried to stop him, but he gets drinking and he gets crazy."
He rattled the key in the lock. Nick stood back, his hand on the gun butt. The cell door opened and Mike stepped out.
"I meant it," he said. "All I want to do is get out of this town."
He sidled past Nick, a grin twitching at his lips. Then he bolted through the door between the small cell block and the office. Nick followed just in time to see the office door closing behind him. Nick went outside. Mike was standing on the curb, his hand on a parking meter, looking at the empty street.
"My God," he whispered, and turned his stunned face to look at Nick. "All this? All this?"
Nick nodded, his hand still on the gun butt. Mike started to say something, and it turned into a coughing spasm. He covered his mouth, then wiped his lips.
"I'm getting the Christ out of here," he said.
"You're wise, you'll do the same thing, Mutie. This is like the Black Death or something."
Nick shrugged, and Mike started down the sidewalk. He moved faster and faster until he was nearly running. Nick watched him until he was out of sight and then went back inside. He never saw Mike again. His heart felt lighter, and he was suddenly sure that he had done the right thing. He lay down on the cot and went to sleep almost at once. He slept all afternoon on the blanketless couch and awoke sweaty but feeling a little better. Thunderstorms were beating the hills. He couldn't hear the thunder, but he could see the blue-white forks of light stabbing the hills. But none had come to Shoyo that night. At dusk, he walked down Main Street to Paulie's radio and TV and committed another of his apologetic break-ins. He left a note by the cash register and lugged a Sony portable back to the jail. He turned it on and flipped through the channels. The CBS affiliate was broadcasting a sign which read, "Microwave relay difficulty, please stay tuned." The ABC station was showing I Love Lucy, and the NBC feed was a rerun episode in a current series about a perky young girl trying to be a mechanic on the stock car circuit. The Texarkana station, an independent specializing mostly in old movies, game shows, and religious zanies of the Jack Van Impe stripe, was off the air. Nick snapped the TV off, went down to the truck stop, and fixed enough soup and sandwiches for two. He thought there was something eerie about the way all the streetlights still came on, stretching out both ways along Main Street in spotlit pools of white light. He put the food in a hamper, and on the way to Jane Baker's house, three or four dogs, obviously unfed and ravenous, advanced on him in a pack, drawn by the smell from the hamper. Nick drew the .45, but couldn't summon up the heart to use it until one of the dogs was getting ready to bite him. Then he pulled the trigger, and the bullet whined off the cement 5 feet in front of him, leaving a silvery streak of lead. The sound of the report did not come to him, but he felt the dull thud of vibration. The dogs broke and ran. Jane was asleep, her forehead and cheeks hot, her breathing slow and labored. She looked dreadfully wasted to Nick. He got a cold washcloth and wiped her face. He left her share of food on the night table, and then went down into the living room and turned on the Baker's TV, a big console color job. CBS didn't come on all night. NBC kept to a regular broadcast schedule, but the picture on the ABC affiliate kept going hazy, sometimes fading out to snow and then snapping back suddenly. The ABC channel showed only old syndication programs, as if its line to the network had been severed. It didn't matter. What Nick was waiting for was the news. When it came on, he was dumbfounded. The superflu epidemic, as it was now being called, was the lead story, but the newscasters on both stations said it was being brought under control. A flu vaccine had been developed at the Atlanta Centers for Disease Control, and you could get a shot from your doctor by early the following week. Outbreaks were reportedly serious in New York, San Francisco, L.A., and London, but all were being contained. In some areas, the newscaster went on, public gatherings had been canceled temporarily. In Shoyo, Nick thought, the entire town had been canceled. Who was kidding who? The newscaster concluded by saying that travel to most of the large city areas was still restricted, but the restrictions would be lifted as soon as the vaccine was in general release. He then went on to a plane crash in Michigan and some congressional reactions to the latest Supreme Court gay rights decision. Nick turned off the TV and went out onto the Baker's porch. There was a glider, and he sat down on it. The back-and-forth motion was soothing, but he couldn't hear the rusty squeak that John Baker had kept forgetting to oil. He watched fireflies as they hemmed irregular seams in the dark. Lightning flashed dully inside the clouds on the horizon, making them look as if they held fireflies of their own, monster fireflies the size of dinosaurs. The night was sticky and close. Because television was a completely visual medium for Nick, he had noticed something about the news broadcast that others might have missed. There had been no film clips, none at all. There had been no baseball scores, maybe because no ball games had been played. A vague weather report and no weather map showing the highs and lows, it was as if the U.S. Bureau of Meteorology had closed up shop. For all Nick knew to the contrary, they had. Both newscasters had seemed nervous and upset. One of them had a cold, He had coughed once on mic and had excused himself. Both newscasters had kept cutting their eyes to the left and right of the camera they were facing, as if someone was in the studio with them, someone who was there to make sure they got it right. That was the night of June 24th, and he slept raggedly on the baker's front porch, and his dreams were very bad. And now, on the afternoon of the following day, he was officiating at the death of Jane Baker, this fine woman, and he couldn't say a word to comfort her. She was tugging at his hand. Nick looked down at her pale, drawn face. Her skin was dry now, the sweat evaporated. He took no hope or comfort in that, however. She was going. He had come to know the look.
"Nick," she said and smiled.
She clasped one of his hands in both of hers.
"I wanted to thank you again. No one wants to die all alone, do they?"
He shook his head violently, and she understood this was not in agreement with her statement, but rather in vehement contradiction of its premise.
"Yes, I am," she contradicted. "But never mind. There's a dress in that closet, Nick. A white one. You'll know it because of..."
A fit of coughing interrupted her. When she had it under control, she finished.
"Because of the lace. It's the one I wore on the train when we left for our honeymoon. It still fits. Or did. I suppose it will be a little big on me now. I've lost some weight. But it doesn't really matter. I've always loved that dress. John and I went to Lake Pontchartrain. It was the happiest 2 weeks of my life. John always made me happy. Will you remember the dress, Nick? It's the one I want to be buried in. You wouldn't be too embarrassed to dress me, would you?"
He swallowed hard and shook his head, looking at the coverlet. She must have sensed his mixture of sadness and discomfort, because she didn't mention the dress again. She talked of other things instead, lightly, almost coquettishly. How she had won an elocution contest in high school, had gone on to the Arkansas State Finals, and how her half-slip had fallen down and puddled around her shoes just as she reached the ringing climax of Shirley Jackson's The Demon Lover. About her sister, who had gone to Vietnam as part of a Baptist mission group and had come back with not one or two but three adopted children. About a camping trip she and John had taken 3 years ago, and how an ill-tempered moose in rut had forced them up a tree and kept them there all day.
"So we sat up there and spooned," she said sleepily, "like a couple of high school kids in a balcony. My goodness, he was in a state when we got down. We were in love, very much in love. Love is what moves the world, I've always thought. It is the only thing which allows men and women to stand in a world where gravity always seems to want to pull them down, bring them low, and make them crawl. We were so much in love."
She drowsed off and slept until he wakened her into fresh delirium by moving a curtain, or perhaps just by treading on a squeaky board.
"John!"
she screamed now, her voice choked with phlegm.
"Oh, John, I'll never get the hang of this dead rat and stick shift. John, you've got to help me. You've got to help me."
Her words trailed off in a long, rattling exhalation he could not hear, but sensed all the same. A thin trickle of dark blood issued from one nostril. She fell back on the pillow, and her head snapped back and forth once, twice, three times, as if she had made some kind of vital decision, and the answer was negative. Then she was still. Nick put his hand timidly against the side of her neck, then her inner wrist, then between her breasts. There was nothing. She was dead. The clock on her bed table ticked importantly, unheard by either of them. He put his head against his knees for a minute, crying a little in the silent way he had. "All you can do is have sort of a slow leak," Rudy had told him once. "But in a soap opera world, that can come in handy." He knew what came next and didn't want to do it. It wasn't fair, part of him cried out. It wasn't his responsibility. But since there was no one else here, maybe no one else well for miles around, he would have to shoulder it. Either that or leave her here to rot, and he couldn't do that. She had been kind to him, and there had been too many people along the way who hadn't been able to spare that, sick or well. He supposed he would have to get going. The longer he sat here and did nothing, the more he would dread the task. He knew where the Curtis funeral home was, 3 blocks down and 1 block west. It would be hot out there, too. He forced himself to get up and go to the closet, half hoping that the white dress, the honeymoon dress, would turn out to have been just another part of her delirium. But it was there. A little yellowed with the years now, but he knew it all the same. Because of the lace. He took it down and laid it across the bench at the foot of the bed. He looked at the dress, looked at the woman, and thought, "It's going to be more than just a little big on her now. The disease, whatever it is, was crueler to her than she knew. And I guess that's just as well." Unwillingly, he went around to her and began to remove the nightgown. But when it was off and she lay naked before him, the dread departed and he felt only pity. A pity lodged so deep in him that it made him ache, and he began to cry again as he washed her body, and then dressed it as it had been dressed when she wore it on the way to Lake Pontchartrain. And when she was dressed as she had been on that day, he took her in his arms and carried her down to the funeral home in her lace. Oh, in her lace. He carried her like a bridegroom crossing an endless threshold with his beloved in his arms. Chapter 26. Some campus group, probably either Students for a Democratic Society or the Young Maoists, had been busy with a ditto machine during the night of June 25th to 26th. In the morning, these posters were plastered all over the University of Kentucky at Louisville campus. "Attention, attention, attention, attention. You are being lied to. The government is lying to you. The press, which has been co-opted by the forces of the pig paramilitary, is lying to you. The administration of this university is lying to you, as are the infirmary doctors under the administration's orders. 1. There is no superflu vaccine. 2. Superflu is not a serious disease, it is a deadly disease. 3. Susceptibility may run as high as 75%. 4. Superflu was developed by the forces of the U.S. pig paramilitary and dispersed by accident. 5. The U.S. pig paramilitary now means to cover up their murderous blunder, even if it means 75% of the population will die. All revolutionary people, greetings. The time of our struggle is now. Unite, strive, conquer. Meeting in gym at 7 p.m. Strike, 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 strike. What happened at WBZ-TV in Boston had been planned the night before by 3 newscasters and 6 technicians, all operating in Studio 6. 5 of these men played poker regularly, and 6 of the 9 were already ill. They felt they had nothing to lose. They collected nearly a dozen handguns. Bob Palmer, who anchored the morning news, brought them upstairs inside a flight bag where he usually carried his notes, pencils, and several legal-sized notepads. The entire broadcast facility was cordoned off by what they had been told were National Guardsmen. But as Palmer had told George Dickerson the night before, they were the only over 50 guardsmen he had ever seen. At 9:01 a.m., just after Palmer had begun to read the soothing copy he had been handed 10 minutes before by an Army non-com, a coup took place. The 9 of them effectively captured the television station. The soldiers, who hadn't expected any real trouble from a soft bunch of civilians accustomed to reporting tragedy at long distance, were taken completely by surprise and disarmed. Other station personnel joined the small rebellion and cleared the 6th floor quickly and locked all the doors. The elevators were brought to 6 before the soldiers on the lobby level quite knew what was happening. 3 soldiers tried to come up the east fire stairs, and a janitor named Charles Yorkin, armed with an Army-issue carbine, fired a shot over their heads. It was the only shot fired. Viewers in the WBZ-TV broadcast area saw Bob Palmer stop his newscast in the middle of a sentence and heard him say, "Okay, right now!" There were scuffling sounds off camera. When it was over, thousands of bemused viewers saw that Bob Palmer was now holding a snub-nosed pistol in his hand. A hoarse off-mic voice yelled jubilantly, "We got 'em, Bob! We got the bastards! We got 'em all!" "Okay, that's good work," Palmer said. He then faced into the camera again. "Fellow citizens of Boston and Americans in our broadcast area, something both grave and terribly important has just happened in this studio, and I am very glad it has happened here first, in Boston, the cradle of American independence. For the last 7 days, this broadcast facility has been under guard by men purporting to be National Guardsmen. Men in army khaki, armed with guns, have been standing beside our cameramen, in our control rooms, beside our teletypes. Has the news been managed? I am sorry to say that this is the case. I have been given copy and forced to read it, almost literally with gun to my head. The copy I have been reading has to do with the so-called superflu epidemic, and all of it is patently false." Lights began to flicker on the switchboard. Within 15 seconds, every light was on. "Our cameramen have taken film that has either been confiscated or deliberately exposed. Our reporters' stories have disappeared. Yet we do have film, ladies and gentlemen, and we have correspondents right here in the studio, not professional reporters, but eyewitnesses to what may be the greatest disaster this country has ever faced. And I do not use those words lightly. We are going to run some of this film for you now. All of it was taken clandestinely, and some of it is of poor quality. Yet we here, who have just liberated our own television station, think you may see enough. More, indeed, than you might have wished." He looked up, took a handkerchief from his sport coat pocket, and blew his nose. Those with good color TVs could see that he looked flushed and feverish. "If it's ready, George, go ahead and run it." Palmer's face was replaced with shots of Boston General Hospital. Wards were crammed. Patients lay on the floors. The halls were full. Nurses, many of them obviously sick themselves, wove in and out, some of them weeping hysterically. Others looked shocked to the point of coma. Shots of guards standing on street corners with cradled rifles. Shots of buildings that had been broken into. Bob Palmer appeared again. "If you have children, ladies and gentlemen," he said quietly, "we would advise that you ask them to leave the room." A grainy shot of a truck backing down a pier, jutting out over Boston Harbor, a big olive-colored army truck. Below it, riding uncertainly, was a barge covered with canvas tarps. Two soldiers, rugose and alien in gas masks, jumped down from the truck's cab. The picture jiggled and joggled, then became steady again as they pulled back the canvas sheet covering the open rear end of the truck. Then they jumped up inside, and bodies began to cascade out onto the barge. Women, old men, children, police, nurses. They came in a cartwheeling flood that seemed never to end. At some point during the film clip, it became clear that the soldiers were using pitchforks to get them out. Palmer went on broadcasting for 2 hours, his steadily hoarsening voice reading clippings and bulletins, interviewing other members of the crew. It went on until somebody on the ground floor realized that they didn't have to retake the sixth floor to stop it. At 11:16, the WBZ transmitter was shut down permanently with 20 pounds of plastique. Palmer and the others on the sixth floor were summarily executed on charges of treason to their government, the United States of America. It was a small town, once-weekly West Virginia newspaper called the Durban Call Clarion, put out by a retired lawyer named James D. Hoglis, and its circulation figures had always been good because Hoglis had been a fiery defender of the miners' right to organize in the late 1940s and in the 1950s, and because his anti-establishment editorials were always filled with hellfire and brimstone missiles aimed at the government hacks at every level, from town to federal. Hoglis had a regular bunch of paper boys, but on this clear summer morning he took the papers around himself in his 1948 Cadillac, the big white wall tires whispering up and down the streets of Durban. And the streets were painfully empty. The papers were piled on the Cadillac's seats and in its trunk. It was the wrong day for the Call Clarion to come out, but the paper was only one page of large type set inside a black border. The word at the top proclaimed "Extra," the first extra edition Hoglis had put out since 1980, when the Ladybird mine had exploded, entombing 40 miners for all time. The headline read, "Government forces try to conceal plague outbreak." Beneath, "Special to the Call Clarion by James D. Hoglis." Below that, It has been revealed to this reporter by a reliable source that the flu epidemic, sometimes called choking sickness or tube neck here in West Virginia, is in reality a deadly mutation of the ordinary flu virus created by this government for purposes of war, and in direct disregard of the revised Geneva Accords concerning germ and chemical warfare, accords which representatives of the United States signed 7 years ago. The source, who is an Army official now stationed in Wheeling, also said that promises of a soon forthcoming vaccine are a bald-faced lie. No vaccine, according to this source, has yet been developed. Citizens, this is more than a disaster or a tragedy. It is the end of all hope in our government. If we have indeed done such a thing to ourselves, then... Hoglis was sick and very weak. He seemed to have used the last of his strength composing the editorial. It had gone from him into the words and had not been replaced. His chest was full of phlegm, and even normal breathing was like running uphill. Yet he went methodically from house to house, leaving his broadsides, not even knowing if the houses were still occupied, or if they were, if anyone inside had enough strength left to go out and pick up what he had left. Finally, he was on the west end of town, Poverty Row, with its shacks and trailers and its rank septic tank smell. Only the papers in the trunk remained, and he left it open, its lid flopping slowly up and down as he went over the washboards in the road. He was trying to cope with a fearsome headache, and his vision kept doubling on him. When the last house, a tumble-down shack near the Rax Crossing town line, was taken care of, he still had a bundle of perhaps 25 papers. He slit the string which bound them with his old pocket knife, and then let the wind take them where the wind would. Thinking of his source, a major with dark, haunted eyes, who had been transferred from something top secret in California called Project Blue only 3 months before. The major had been charged with outside security there, and he kept fingering the pistol on his hip as he told Hoglis everything he knew. Hoglis thought it would not be long before the major used the gun, if he hadn't used it already. He climbed back behind the wheel of the Cadillac, the only car he had owned since his 27th birthday, and discovered he was too tired to drive back to town. So he leaned back sleepily, listened to the drowning sounds coming from his chest, and watched the wind blow his extra additions lazily up the road toward Rax Crossing. Some of them had caught in the overhanging trees, where they hung like strange fruit. Nearby, he could hear the bubbling, racing sound of Durban Stream, where he had fished as a boy. There were no fish in it now, of course. The coal companies had seen to that, but the sound was still soothing. He closed his eyes, slept, and died an hour and a half later. The Los Angeles Times ran only 26,000 copies of their one-page extra before the officers in charge discovered that they were not printing an advertising circular, as they had been told. The reprisal was swift and bloody. The official FBI story was that radical revolutionaries, that old bugaboo, had dynamited the LA Times presses, causing the death of 28 workers. The FBI didn't have to explain how the explosion had put bullets in each of the 28 heads, because the bodies were mingled with those of thousands of others, epidemic victims who were being buried at sea. Yet 10,000 copies got out, and that was enough. The headline, in 36-point type, screamed, "West Coast in grip of plague epidemic. Thousands flee deadly superflu. Government cover-up certain. Los Angeles." Some of the soldiers purporting to be National Guardsmen helping out during the current ongoing tragedy are career soldiers with as many as 4 10-year pips on their sleeves. Part of their job is to assure terrified Los Angeles residents that the superflu, known as Captain Trips by the young in most areas, is only slightly more virulent than the London or Hong Kong strains, but these assurances are made through portable respirators. The president is scheduled to speak tonight at 6 Pacific Standard Time, and his press secretary, Hubert Ross, has branded reports that the president will speak from a set mocked up to look like the Oval Office, but actually deep in the White House bunker, hysterical, vicious, and totally unfounded. Advance copies of the president's speech indicate that he will spank the American people for overreacting and compare the current panic to that which followed Orson Welles's War of the Worlds radio broadcast in the early 30s. The Times has 5 questions it wishes the president would answer in his speech. 1. Why has the Times been enjoined from printing the news by thugs in army uniforms, in direct violation of its constitutional right to do so? 2. Why have the following highways, US 5, US 10, and US 15, been blocked off by armored cars and troop carriers? 3. If this is a minor outbreak of flu, why has martial law been declared for Los Angeles and surrounding areas? 4. If this is a minor outbreak of flu, then why are barge trains being towed out into the Pacific and dumped? And do these barges contain what we are afraid they contain, and what informed sources have assured us they do contain? The dead bodies of plague victims? 5. Finally, if a vaccine really is to be distributed to doctors and area hospitals early next week, why has not one of the 46 physicians that this newspaper contacted for further details heard of any delivery plans? Why has not one clinic been set up to administer flu shots? Why has not one of the 10 pharmaceutical houses we called gotten freight invoices or government flyers on this vaccine? We call upon the president to answer these questions in his speech, and above all, we call upon him to end these police state tactics and this insane effort to cover up the truth. In Duluth, a man in khaki shorts and sandals walked up and down Piedmont Avenue with a large smear of ash on his forehead and a hand-lettered sandwich board hanging over his scrawny shoulders. The front read, "The time of the disappearance is here. Christ the Lord returneth soon. Prepare to meet your God." The back read, "Behold, the hearts of the sinners were broken. The great shall be abased and the abased made great. The evil days are at hand. Woe to thee, O Zion." 4 young men in motorcycle jackets, all of them with bad coughs and runny noses, set upon the man in the khaki shorts and beat him unconscious with his own sandwich board. Then they fled, one of them calling back hysterically over his shoulder, "Teach you to scare people? Teach you to scare people, you half-baked freak?" The highest-rated morning program in Springfield, Missouri, was KLFT's morning phone-in show, Speak Your Peace, with Ray Flowers. He had 6 phone lines into his studio booth, and on the morning of June 26th, he was the only KLFT employee to show up for work. He was aware of what was going on in the outside world, and it scared him. In the last week or so, it seemed to Ray that everyone he knew had come down sick. There were no troops in Springfield, but he had heard that the National Guard had been called into KC and St. Louis to stop the spread of panic and prevent looting. Ray Flowers himself felt fine. He looked thoughtfully at his equipment, phones, time delay device to edit those callers who lapsed into profanity from time to time, racks of commercials on cassettes. "If your toilet overflows and you don't know just what goes, call for the man with the big steel hose. Call your clean-out man." And, of course, the mic. He lit a cigarette, went to the studio door, and locked it. Went into his booth and locked that. He turned off the canned music that had been playing from a tape reel, turned on his own theme music, and then settled in at the microphone. "Hi, y'all," he said. "This is Ray Flowers on Speak Your Peace. And this morning I guess there's only one thing to call about, isn't there? You can call it Tube Neck or Superflu or Captain Trips, but it all means the same thing. I've heard some horror stories about the Army clamping down on everything, and if you want to talk about that, I'm ready to listen. It's still a free country, right? And since I'm here by myself this morning, we're going to do things just a little bit differently. I've got the time delay turned off, and I think we can dispense with the commercials. If the Springfield you're seeing is anything like the one I'm seeing from the KLFT windows, no one feels much like shopping anyway. Okay. So if you're supposed to be up and around, as my mother used to say, let's get going. Our toll-free numbers are 555-8600 and 555-8601. If you get a busy, just be patient. Remember, I'm doing it all myself." There was an army unit in Carthage, 50 miles from Springfield, and a 20-man patrol was dispatched to take care of Ray Flowers. 2 men refused the order. They were shot on the spot. In the hour it took them to get to Springfield, Ray Flowers took calls from a doctor who said people were dying like flies and who thought the government was lying through its teeth about a vaccine, a hospital nurse who confirmed that bodies were being removed from Kansas City hospitals by the truckload, a delirious woman who claimed it was flying saucers from outer space, a farmer who said that an army squad with two payloaders had just finished digging a hell of a long ditch in a field near Route 71, south of Kansas City, half a dozen others with their own stories to tell. Then there was a crashing sound on the outer studio door.
"Open up!" a muffled voice cried. "Open up in the name of the United States!"
Ray looked at his watch. 11:45. "Well," he said, "it looks like the Marines have landed. But we'll just keep taking calls, shall we?" There was a rattle of automatic rifle fire, and the knob of the studio door thumped onto the rug. Blue smoke drifted out of the ragged hole. The door was shouldered inward, and half a dozen soldiers, wearing respirators and full battle dress, burst in.
"Several soldiers have just broken into the outer office," Ray said. "They're fully armed. They look like they're ready to start a mop-up operation in France 50 years ago, except for the respirators on their faces."
"Shut it down!"
a heavy-set man with sergeant's stripes on his sleeves yelled. He loomed outside the broadcast booth's glass walls and gestured with his rifle.
"I think not," Ray called back.
He felt very cold, and when he fumbled his cigarette out of his ashtray, he saw that his fingers were trembling.
"This station is licensed by the FCC, and I'm—"
"I'm revoking your fucking license now. Shut down!"
"I think not," Ray said again, and turned back to his microphone. "Ladies and gentlemen, I've been ordered to shut down the KLFT transmitter, and I've refused the order, quite properly, I think. These men are acting like Nazis, not American soldiers. I am not—"
"Last chance!"
The sergeant brought his gun up. "Sergeant," one of the soldiers by the door said, "I don't think you can just—"
"If that man says anything else, waste him," the sergeant said.
"I think they're going to shoot me," Ray Flowers said. And the next moment the glass of his broadcast booth blew inward, and he fell over his control panel. From somewhere there came a terrific feedback whine that spiraled up and up. The sergeant fired his entire clip into the control panel, and the feedback cut off. The lights on the switchboard continued to blink.
"Okay," the sergeant said, turning around. "I want to get back to Carthage by 1 o'clock, and I don't—"
Three of his men opened up on him simultaneously, one of them with a recoilless rifle that fired 70 gas-tipped slugs per second. The sergeant did a jigging, shuffling death dance, and then fell backward through the shattered remains of the broadcast booth's glass wall. One leg spasmed, and his combat boot kicked shards of glass from the frame. A PFC, pimples standing out in stark relief on his whey-colored face, burst into tears. The others only stood in stunned disbelief. The smell of cordite was heavy and sickening in the air.
"We scragged him," the PFC cried hysterically. "Holy God, we done scragged Sergeant Peters!"
No one replied. Their faces were still dazed and uncomprehending, although later they would only wish they had done it sooner. All of this was some deadly game, but it wasn't their game. The phone, which Ray Flowers had put in the amplifier cradle just before he died, gave out a series of squawks.
"Ray? You there, Ray?"
The voice was tired, nasal.
"I listen to your program all the time, me and my husband both, and we just wanted to say keep up the good work and don't let them bully you. Okay, Ray? Ray? Ray?"
Communique 234, Zone 2, Secret, Scramble, from Landon, Zone 2, New York, to Creighton, commanding, Ray, Operation Carnival. Follows. New York cordon still operative, disposal of bodies proceeding, city relatively quiet. X. Cover story unraveling faster than expected, but so far nothing we can't handle from city population. Superflu is keeping most of them inside. XX. Now estimate that 50% of troops manning barricades at points of egress-ingress— George Wash Bridge, Triborough Bridge, Brooklyn Bridge, Lincoln and Holland Tunnels, plus limited access highways in the outer boroughs. Now ill with superflu. Most troops still capable of active duty and performing well. XXX. Three fires out of control in city, Harlem 7th Avenue, Shea Stadium. XXXX. Desertion from ranks becoming